It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Earlier this month, Wisconsin started seeing our first big snowfalls of the winter as an Arctic blast brought major storms and sub-zero temperatures to states around the country. And polar vortex experts say there might be more of that headed our way next month. Whether it's a big storm or typical Wisconsin snow, it is plowing season. Our next guests are Public Works employees. They've seen it all, and they're here to tell us what goes into keeping the roads clear and safe during the winter months and answer your snowplow questions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your experience of snow and ice removal in your community in general, in the storms that came through in the last couple of weeks? How do you try to stay safe on the road during winter weather conditions? What questions do you have about snow plowing? And if you've ever been a snowplow operator yourself, love to hear your experiences. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kaylin Jenick is Operations Services Manager with the Milwaukee Department of Public Works. Kaylin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Gene Derone is a truck driver and driver trainer for the Milwaukee Department of Public Works. Gene, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
All right, Kaylin, take us through it. You're watching the weather. You see a big storm is coming through. What goes into making that plan for the next storm that's coming along?
A lot of that planning has happened even back in April before it even started snowing. And so we start planning for snow year round to get our trucks ready, to make sure we have the equipment we need, to get our drivers trained to be able to handle that snow and ice control. And then we spend a lot of time in late summer and fall training our supervisors and managers and folks to keep an eye on the streets and let us know how we're doing. Once we start to see the weather forecast showing snow, we use a lot of different sources for weather. And it's our biggest challenge because weather forecasts are a chaotic science. So we might get forecasts saying we're going to get a foot of snow. And then 2 days later, it can be down to just an inch. Or vice versa, they could say we're only going to get 2 inches of snow and all of a sudden we have eight. So part of our planning is to be prepared for whatever Mother Nature throws at us as much as possible. And so we start planning, we start making sure that we have the trucks, the drivers we need, that they know their routes. And we're just trying to figure out all the details of what time to start an event, to have those operators go out, how much salt to use, what type of blade to have on the truck, because our trucks have two blades. And then we just start adapting depending on what that actual storm turns out to be.
Gene, Kaylin mentioned training. You drive for the city, not just snow plows, I understand, but you also help train people. What goes into training somebody to drive a snow plow?
Well, I started out as a snow plow driver for several years, and then I became a driver trainer. And I've taken all types of commercial drivers, truck drivers, safety and defensive driving courses. And we do train each one of our drivers with all the tools that we have, such as training videos, behind the wheel training, on the job training. And we also do hands on with all of our drivers. They start off as normal drivers, and then they go through our commercial drivers program that takes several months in some cases, because they start off with the early learning driver training. And then they come through our behind the wheel training. And then we put them into snowplows after they've completed all of that training. And when the wintertime comes, we kind of gear up towards winter operation, which we start doing safety meetings and we do briefings on safe driving techniques and snowplow operation to get prepared when we do get a heavy snowfall.
This year, we also had an opportunity to use our driving simulators, which was some new technology for us to use. And it gave a realistic opportunity for some of our new drivers to see what it's like to snowplow, because we have to train folks when there isn't snow on the ground, but our trainers do a great job of also getting out in the field when there's snow to make sure that those lessons have absorbed and making corrections as needed.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Greg is with us in Milwaukee. Greg, hi.
Hello. I live close to the Port of Milwaukee, and I go to the Board of Harbor Commissioners meetings, and the city makes the most money from the Port of Milwaukee from dry bulk storage of road salt. So there's an incentive to use road salt. We have I understand no state laws indicating that salt is toxic to fresh water. Many other areas of the country use something besides salt because their drinking water supplies are very shallow.
Greg, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. And Kaylin, I was looking at your frequently asked questions there. Right at the top of the list are, why don't we use less salt and why don't we use more salt? How do you weigh the different alternatives when it comes to how much salt to use?
Sure. We absolutely get both sides of the question. And for us, it's important to use less salt because there is an environmental impact as well as there's a fiscal impact to using salt. At the same time, our highest priority is public safety. And in a city like Milwaukee, where we have a lot of vehicles driving, a lot of our streets may be at a higher speed than some other communities, that public safety element is really important. And so we really look to the weather to dictate and what current conditions are. So pavement forecasts are really important. Listeners may be more familiar with air temperatures, but when we're determining our salt application rates, we're looking at the pavement of how warm that is to determine if salt's going to be more effective. If we can use less salt, because if the pavement's going to be warmer, we'll use less pounds per lane mile. If it's going to be colder, we do need to ramp up how much salt we use. But we do also still have a limit on how much salt we'll use. And whenever there is measurable snow, we're always going to plow that snow first, be it with our front plow blade or underbelly blade, so that we're mechanically pushing and salting as little as we can. But we're going to maintain that public safety first.
Great. And we also try to use alternative salt means, such as brine materials. We have tried some other alternative salt measures in the past, but we do have to have enough application on the road to keep the road safe at all times.
Greg, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Mike joins us now in La Crosse. Mike, hi.
Hello, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up, Mike?
Yeah, with the last storm we had in La Crosse, there were several inches of snow, and the snowplow came up several times and plowed by our street, and I appreciate that. But at the same time, every time he plowed, he would put down a mixture of sand salt for traction, which I appreciate. But after a few minutes, it was just covered up again. And then the next time that he came, he would plow that sand salt mixture off the road. That does not make any sense to me. Is that a proper practice?
Mike, thanks for the...
It allows for traction for a short period of time, but then the snow just covers it up again.
Mike, thanks for the call. Gene, do you find yourself plowing that last application of salt in the next round of plowing?
Yeah, absolutely. We try to, as we use plows to push the snow out of the road, we try to put a light application of salt down. We don't put a heavy application of salt until we've completely plowed down. If he's talking about a residential street, we try to plow the street first with mechanical means, such as a plow pushing the snow either to one side of the street or the other. And then at the end of plowing the street, then we try to come through with the application of salt. However, depending on how many lane miles this person has to plow, they have to complete, you know, one pass through each lane mile before they plow it to the side. So there might be a delay for 40 minutes until he turns around and gets back to that same street. So he might have one of those situations, but we don't put all the salt down and plow it to the side. That doesn't make a lot of sense. We try to keep the salt on the truck for traction, because once that salt runs out, we start spinning around. So we keep the salt on the truck until we've plowed the streets. And then we do a last application as we leave those residential areas.
Mike, thanks for the call. We are talking to Gene Durone, truck driver and trainer, and Kaylin Jenick, operations services manager, both with the Milwaukee Department of Public Works. They're with us for a look behind the plow, what goes into removing ice and snow from city streets in the winter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you happy with the snow and ice removal services in your own community? What's it been like navigating streets, bike lanes, crosswalks in your community this year? Have you ever done this job? Have you been a snowplow driver yourself? What was that experience like? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Kaylin Jenick and Gene Durone from Milwaukee's Department of Public Works about the ins and outs of snow plowing as we make our way through another Wisconsin winter. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions on our guest. If there's something that confuses you about why plowing happens the way it does, 800-642-1234 is the number. I want to ask each a question, though, before we get back to our callers. Gene, first of all, you know, you're out driving the plows. Other people, you know, ordinary folks like us are out there driving. Can you give us some ideal model behavior for those other drivers when they're in the vicinity of a snowplow?
That's a very good question. It's a very good point. When we're driving these snowplows, they're very large vehicles. Some of them we're wide at that time because we have plows off to the side, or our plows are wider than the truck itself. Yeah, the only thing I can tell someone that can help me as I'm snowplowing is to, you know, give me enough room in case I have to stop for something, or give me enough room to plow if I'm plowing to one side or the other. Give me enough room to maneuver the truck, especially if I'm going in and into a curb lane where I'm in and out of parked vehicles. If I go into a curb lane, let me back out in the street, because I cannot clear the path if I got to let all the traffic through. I try to work with the traffic at all times, and the best thing someone can do is just back off and give me about 50 feet so I can do my job.
And Kaylin, it seems like the worst cases I see over the years, and this is something that happened last week here in Wisconsin, or a couple of weeks ago, when we have a lot of snow and then the temperature plummets, it goes way down below freezing. Can you talk about why that's an extra challenge?
Sure. It's an extra challenge because that freezing really just turns the snow into ice. And so the plow blades don't necessarily have enough down pressure to get below that snow and ice to be able to push it off the street. And because we are concerned about our salt use, so the amount of salt you would need to use to burn that ice off isn't worth it for us. And so there is going to be some hard pack left on the streets with that freeze, especially with that heavy amount of snow. To clear our streets, we really rely on the three T's of time, temperature, and traffic. That sometimes you need those three things to come together. You need time for product to work. You need the temperature to be warm enough for it to work and to impact the snow and ice. And then you need the traffic to also break it up. And when it's really cold, we really don't get any of those three, because the traffic's not going to break it up, the temperature's not in our favor, and time isn't going to do us any favors because it's just too cold for us to be able to make progress.
Let's go back to our callers now. Dan is with us in Muscadet. Dan, hi.
Yes, I hear you mention this brine. I'm really curious, how did we ever develop to start using this, and where did it come from, and how does it compare to putting salt down? Does it last longer than salt? Or?
Gotcha. Dan, Brian, who wants to tackle that one, the basics of brining our roads?
Yeah, so brine, it's actually salt water. So it's a 23.3% salt water solution that we use to really reduce of how much salt we use. So brine can be used in two ways. We use it when we're in an event to pre-wet the salt. So it will spray as the salt is coming out of the spinner. We use spinners. There's some other equipment that municipalities may use. And that brine hitting the salt activates it a little bit quicker because it needs moisture to activate, as well as it prevents the salt from bouncing as much. So it really stays in the driving lane more instead of bouncing into our parking lanes. The other way that we've used brine significantly more and a lot of municipalities are moving towards is pre-brining the streets or anti-icing. And so using that liquid instead, that salt really stays on the street and can prevent the ice from bonding to the pavement. So it's easier for us to take care of later, as well as sometimes we can anti-ice. And if it's a very small event, that brine on the street, we don't need to have all of our trucks go out and salt, because that brine has taken care of the minimal amount of ice or snow that may have been on that street.
And Gene, can you see the difference with brining in those two strategies, you know, in real time?
Yes, you can see the difference. Brine gives us more time to get out to the streets, because we can brine before the actual snow event. And that kind of keeps the streets passable until we can get back out there again with a plow or more salt to help the brine start working.
Thanks a lot for that question, Dan. Appreciate it. Back to your calls. Greg is with us in Mesa Mani. Greg, hi.
Hi. Hey, I'm curious. I watched the town patrolman go back and forth a couple passes today. And in every case, the blade is like 2.5-3 inches above the pavement. Why aren't they cutting it down to the pavement and getting that slush off the road?
Greg, thanks for the call. My wife had a similar question last week. Gene, why would we not be going right down to the pavement with the blades?
That's a good question. I don't know why they wouldn't get to the pavement. Maybe because once the ice bonds to the pavement, the plows don't have enough down pressure to kind of push it all the way down to that clear pavement. And that's one of the things that we have to get out on the streets before that starts to bond to the pavement, because once that snow gets driven over, it becomes like a hard compact of ice, and then the plow can't push down hard enough to bring it back off the ground again.
So that operator could also potentially be using the underbelly blade. Usually that front blade might be would be higher than 2 to 3 inches. But a lot of salt trucks also have a blade underneath it that they might be using, that because sometimes they find that gets a little bit more down pressure, can handle smaller amounts.
Thanks a lot for that call, Greg. Now, Kaylin, some communities have had naming events for their plows, you know, Plowy McPlowface and Darth Blader and things like that. Is that something you do in Milwaukee at all?
A little bit. We did it last year. Part of it is we love the experience of our operators. We have an incredibly dedicated team working 24/7 to do these snow events. And so we did a raffle for our main team drivers. And so we did have some drivers who named their trucks. This year, the city of Milwaukee has a big truck day in May that we invite the public to come see all of our equipment during National Public Works Week. And so we're planning on doing some truck naming at those event, at that event.
And Gene, in our last few moments, what is a day like? We've got a long, sustained snowstorm. How long are you personally out there on the roads plowing?
Well, at the initial start of a snowstorm, we work long hours, as many as we can safely drive. And then we try to maintain safe drivers by bringing in fresh crews of drivers. Sometimes it's 10 to 12 hour operations. Sometimes we go into an 8 to 10 hour operation. It all depends on the storm and the time that the snow is actually going to fall. Some of our drivers, Kayla mentioned that we do a 24 hour operation because some of our drivers might get called in at midnight and their normal shifts is 7 or 8 in the morning. So they have already worked 8-9 hours before the start of their normal shift in the first place. So it all depends on the type of snow, the type of operation. So it's kind of a juggle sometimes. There might be a 12 hour shift on some days, and that's how we maintain fresh drivers. And we attack it. That's the point where we always keep a defensive and safe driving techniques, because once the driver becomes fatigued, then mistakes tend to happen. So.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to both of our guests, Gene Derone and Kaylin Jenick from Milwaukee's Department of Public Works, giving us some snow plowing 101. Last 2 years, hundreds of new immigrants and asylum seekers have settled in Whitewater. This month, officials there sent a letter to President Biden asking for help dealing with changes that come along with their newest residents. Evan Casey reports on how the newcomers are affecting the community.
Byron spent 17 days traveling from Nicaragua through Central America to get to the United States. He left his past life behind in search of a better one in America.
I might have better opportunities here because that's what I aim here, try to find a better place to live, try to feel safe, try to work hard.
Nicaragua is an authoritarian regime, and Byron is now seeking asylum here in America. He didn't want his last name used in this story out of concerns for his safety. When he reached the U.S.-Mexico border, he was allowed to be received by friends where they live, in Whitewater, Wisconsin. At the home's kitchen table, Byron wears a black AC/DC shirt and a crucifix around his neck. He's growing his hair out. The cold is still something he's getting used to, and he thinks it'll help him stay warmer in the winter. But the 27-year-old also says he feels happy and grateful to be here.
I really like it. I mean, I love. That's why I never moved from Whitewater. I'm not planning to move, actually.
Byron is just one of the recent immigrants who have settled in the small college town in the past few years. Many of them are refugees from Nicaragua or Venezuela. The city estimates there could be anywhere from 800 to 1,000 of them now living in the city of 15,000. Juana Barajas owns a Mexican grocery store with her family on Main Street. She's now offering items with the Nicaraguan and Venezuelan flags on them and is even making different types of food for the newcomers.
Now, of course, I'm making food, Mexican food, but I'm making a lot of nacatamales, a lot of, you know, caldos. Well, they don't call them caldos, they call them sopa.
Marjorie Stoneman, who leads the community group Whitewater Unites Lives, also says it's important to welcome the newcomers.
We really want to make sure that people recognize that newcomers to our town are welcome, and that we respect everybody, where they're from, no matter where they're from or what their religion or what their beliefs are.
But the arrivals haven't come without new challenges for the city, as the newcomers have strained public services. Whitewater Police Chief Dan Meyer says in 1 week in January 2022, the city experienced a few major incidents that spurred a citywide discussion about how to deal with the influx. He says police found a family with a 3-year-old and a 2-year-old living inside a 10-by-10 shed in below zero temperatures. They also found 2 young children living in an empty building where a fire started.
In a very short span of time, it couldn't be more clear that we had an issue that was needed to be addressed immediately.
Meyer wants to see new funding for an immigrant liaison position and more officers. Ultimately, he says his goal is to better serve the new population.
Whether or not the numbers, you know, say it's 200 or it's 2,000, what matters is our statistics point to a huge need for resources.
Some law enforcement and politicians have claimed that some of the immigrants are connected to the illegal drug trade. Meyer says it's too soon to know if that's actually occurring or not. Southeastern Wisconsin may seem like an unlikely place for such immigration, but many migrants make decisions the same way Byron did. They go where they know someone. When one family or group settles in a spot, they tell others it's safe to come. Immigration attorney Mark Christopher says he believes similar stories are occurring across Wisconsin and other smaller Midwestern cities. He says it could be years until asylum cases for many of the new immigrants are completed. In the meantime, he says they're hard workers and do their best to fit in.
They acclimate themselves into our schools and our community, and in my experience, they bring an extra positive element to any community.
That's been the case for Byron. He's now volunteering at a food pantry to help others like him. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more from the WPR News Department at the newly redesigned WPR.org. While you're there, check out the show's page and browse the archives of all your favorite programs. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Now, despite being a huge part of a healthy diet, veggies are often an afterthought when we cook, a side dish maybe, or something to add a little color to the main course. But knowing how to properly choose, store, and cook vegetables can elevate them from a sidekick to a standout success. The author of a new vegetable cookbook is here on Food Friday to break down the science of making delicious, vegetable-focused meals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are some of your favorite veggies to cook with this time of year in particular? Have you tried any new-to-you vegetables lately? Do you have any vegetable cooking hacks or recipes you want to brag about? Or is there something you want to like or you've had it better when someone else makes it and you are trying to figure out what to do with it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nick Sharma is a molecular biologist, writer, photographer, and chef behind the award-winning food blog, A Brown Table. He's the author of the new cookbook, Vegetable, Recipes, Techniques, and Plant Science for Big-Flavored, Vegetable-Focused Meals. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on your show today.
What led you to tackle a book focusing on the humble vegetable family?
Because no one else has. I really wanted to write a book about the science of vegetables, but also just make it fun and approachable so people could have big bowl flavors and spend less time in the kitchen and appreciate vegetables for what they are.
And what are vegetables? I know, you know, somebody could tell me, Rob, a cucumber is actually technically a fruit. A tomato is technically a fruit. Yeah, okay. Botanically, how are we talking about vegetables when we're talking about cooking them?
Okay, so that was really an interesting thing to bring up, because when I was writing the book, I was stumped trying to find what's the definition of a vegetable. And it turns out that in biology, most of the vegetables, like you mentioned, are usually fruits. But there is no definition of vegetables in biology, and it's more of a colloquial thing where it's based on use. So a vegetable could definitely be a fruit. It could also be a leaf, a stem, a root. It's basically how we cook it and if we're treating it in a savory fashion. that's what makes a vegetable.
Well, the nice thing, I think if we surveyed people, we'd all pretty much agree on what's a vegetable and what's not for the most part. Did you find any arguments or pushback for people like mushrooms don't count or anything like that?
You know what? I had to leave mushrooms out of the book as a separate chapter because mushrooms aren't really plants.
Right.
And yeah, so I definitely received a few comments from people who were like, wow, maybe you should have included avocados, for example, because we eat avocados mostly, you know, kind of in like a vegetable. But I left them out because I think of them as a fruit. So there were definitely some people who felt that certain vegetables that they were really attached to should have been in the book. And I think that was the biggest controversy that I dealt with.
Nick, my biggest problem with vegetables is I buy them and in some cases I don't use them fast enough. Apart from planning ahead to use those vegetables, can you talk a little bit about, you know, some basic advice on avoiding spoilage?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the most important things because I feel vegetables these days, they cost a lot of money. You're taking time to go to the farmer's market or the grocery store. So it's really important you get the most bang for your buck. Now, with vegetables, if they're really wet, like, you know, especially things that are green, they photosynthesize, they produce water, wrap them up in paper and put them in the refrigerator. There are some vegetables that are better left at room temperature, like tomatoes and even cucumbers. I used to keep cucumbers in the refrigerator, but it turns out they're better stored at room temperature. Huh. And then a lot of vegetables and even fruits are better kept in the dark than they are in direct sunlight because they start to ripen and go bad really quick. So, you know, cutting access to oxygen, keeping them at low temperatures and keeping them away from sunlight are huge, huge saving graces for them.
And you write that some vegetables don't play well with others, that they actually release a chemical that makes other kinds of vegetables go bad faster?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, coming back to the point of which vegetables are fruits, a lot of the ones that are technically fruits, like tomatoes, for example, if you keep them next to broccoli or next to kale or collards, they'll start to release this plant ripening hormone called ethylene. And ethylene will eventually make the broccoli and all these green vegetables turn yellow and go bad really quick. So keep them separate. That's really important. And this holds true for any type of fruit like apples, pears, bananas. Keep them away from your vegetables.
It's Food Friday. Nick Sharma is with us talking about his new cookbook. It's called Vegetable Recipes, Techniques, and Plant Science for Big Flavored Vegetable-Focused Meals. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your favorite vegetables or maybe some advice you need on how to cook a particular kind of vegetable. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Nick, I want to check out one of the recipes you shared with us, Brussels sprouts. Now, Brussels sprouts in the United States, they're so much better than there used to be. And you've got, this looks great, sweet and sticky Brussels sprouts. Talk about what's making these sprouts sweet, sticky, and delicious.
Okay, so I like sweet and sour. That's one of my favorite two flavor combinations. And so these Brussels sprouts, they're roasted, and then they're kind of just tossed in a sauce made with mirin, which is a Japanese sweet wine. There's a little bit of miso to add savoriness, saltiness, and a little bit of honey, which adds sweetness. You can also use maple syrup and make this vegan. Fold it all together. It eventually just creates this beautiful umami, sweet, salty sauce that's nice and sticky. And I like eating it by itself, just with rice. It's so good.
Can you talk about roasting a little bit? You say in the book, Brussels sprouts are still best roasted. Give some basic roasting advice for sprouts and other vegetables that would do well in the oven.
Absolutely. So with any vegetable, if you're trying to roast them, my tip of the day, and this, you know, it holds universally true, is to place them on a wire rack on a baking sheet and then stick them in the oven. What happens is any liquid that's coming out from the vegetables falls to the bottom of the pan and dries off. Otherwise, everything ends up sitting in a pool of water. It also just helps the hot air in the oven flow around it much better. Another tip that I tell people is add a pinch of salt. Don't over-season it. And then also add a little bit of baking soda, maybe 1/8 of a teaspoon to a pound of Brussels sprouts. Toss them together. Just a tiny amount of baking soda will help it caramelize even faster and help develop those beautiful caramelly, nutty flavors that we love.
And speaking of caramelizing, you talk about one of the most sugar-rich vegetables out there is onions and their close relatives. I don't think of, I mean, you talk about sweet onions, I guess. Talk about the amount of sugar we have in the onion family and how we can make the most of it.
Yeah, so onions, garlic, and other members of the allium family, they contain these long, long chains, or rather polymers, of fructose. And fructose is the sugar that makes honey sweet. So now you think about that. You've got these chains of these molecules all tied together, fructose. When an onion is cooked down, the pungency goes away, and then it starts to reveal its sweet character. So, you know, when you're making onion jam, that's probably the most easy example to imagine. It tastes very sweet because you're cooking all those onions down, those polymers are breaking down, and it's releasing that sweet sugar, fructose. So onions are actually one of the most sweet vegetables in the vegetable world.
You write in the book that, you know, yes, fresh vegetables are lovely and great, and they're not always, you know, seasonal when you want them. When do you reach or suggest people reach for frozen veggies or canned veggies that's going to work out just fine?
That's a really good question. So I always tell people, if you can't find something, but if you know it's available frozen, go for it. Because often frozen vegetables actually are richer in nutrients because they don't spend that much time from the farm to reach the market or your grocery store. When they're frozen, they come straight off the plant, they're processed minimally and frozen, so all the nutrients are, you know, retained. For example, during Thanksgiving and during Christmas holidays, a lot of people cook sweet corn. Now, if you're cooking sweet corn, I would tell people just buy frozen because it's much sweeter in taste, the flavor is better, and it holds on to its crunch. Spinach, that's a really another great vegetable. If you don't want to deal with cups and cups and bags of spinach just to make one cup of cooked spinach because it shrinks down, just buy frozen spinach because it's already shrunken down and you get more value for your money. So there are a lot of amazing frozen vegetables out there. Don't feel shy. Get it, especially if it's not in season and you're having a craving.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to molecular biologist turned author Nick Sharma. His new cookbook is Vegetable Recipes, Techniques, and Plant Science for Big-Flavored Vegetable-Focused Meals. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you have a family recipe for a vegetable dish you would like to share? Is there a go-to that everybody in the family, maybe even the kids, love to eat? Is there a vegetable that everybody else hates but you like, or vice versa? Are you the only person in your family who likes beets, say like me? Join in with your favorites, your questions on how to prepare veggies for best effect at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with molecular biologist, writer, photographer, and chef Nick Sharma. His new cookbook is called Vegetable: Recipes, Techniques, and Plant Science for Big-Flavored Vegetable-Focused Meals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been struggling with bland or soggy vegetables, or was that what vegetables looked like maybe growing up for you? Do you have trouble keeping vegetables fresh until you can use them? Is there something not turning out right in that vegetable dish? Call in with your favorites, your questions for our guest, maybe something you found that's a big hit with the kids in your family in the vegetable world, even if they're fussy eaters. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nick, do you have thoughts for that? You know, there are people, grown-ups and kids, who might say, yeah, I just generally don't like vegetables. Do you have, you know, gateway vegetables or dishes that you could help win people over with?
Absolutely. I think start with something simple like cabbages. So if, you know, kids don't like vegetables, and I was a kid that also hated vegetables. I always asked for, you know, like I wanted my steak or I wanted chicken or fish. But with vegetables, I think start with vegetables that, you know, they aren't that smelly. The textures are really comfortable. So carrots, cabbage, potatoes, peas, those are generally crowd pleasers. And once you start, you know, teaching kids to appreciate those textures, then slowly start bringing other vegetables in. I think it's always a really good idea to slide things in slowly and sneakily, and to make sure people appreciate them. And then find out what, you know, flavors they like. So if someone likes, leans more towards savory, why not cook cabbages with tomatoes? Or some other kind of pasta sauce maybe, you know? So there are always ways to kind of make vegetables more fun and flavorful. And make sure you play with textures, because unlike meat, vegetables have a lot of different colors and textures that you can enjoy playing with. And often kids love that.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chrissy is with us in Madison. Chrissy, hi.
Hi. I want to thank you so much for this because it's my birthday today and I'm a vegetarian. So a lot of times on the Fridays, this doesn't really set in with me, and this is absolutely perfect. So I appreciate that. I have vegetarian kids as well, and the bowls actually work amazing. So they love when I make stuffed peppers or squash bowls with different vegetables in them, and it just works out great. So I'm really looking forward to reading your book. Thank you.
Chrissy, happy birthday. I don't want to let you go quite yet. Talk about, so when you say squash bowl, you got like what, two halves of an acorn squash, and they're the actual bowls and the squash and other stuff, you serve it up in there?
Oh, yes. And so my favorite is the acorn squash, but we grow our own squash as well. So we grow acorn and then spaghetti squash, which is a fabulous, fabulous, because it gives you so much food in just one little squash. And you can make spaghetti or lasagna or whatever out of it. And then the peppers, we just kind of carve out and we put in rice. And then also like other peppers or tomatoes and that sort of thing in it with some spices. And the kids absolutely love it.
Chrissy, thanks so much for sharing that. And Nick, one of my favorite things about Wisconsin in the fall and winter months is all the squash. Do you have favorite ways to work with winter squash?
Oh, absolutely. Just like Chrissy said, one of my favorite winter squashes is the acorn squash, because I feel unlike pumpkins, the flavor is much stronger and is not as sweet. So what I love to do with acorn squashes, toss it with a little bit of olive oil and salt after slicing it, stick it in the oven, roast it, and then I add a little bit of sauteed kale and I cook up some onions with a little bit of paprika and salt and pepper and a little bit of vinegar. Put it all together, and so it's sweet, salty, just plays so well. It's one of my favorite dishes to make.
And thanks again for that call, Chrissy. Nick, I've got a squash at home. It's like acorn, but that mottled color. I never remember what they're called. It is destined to become soup over the weekend. Are you a big fan of turning your vegetables into various kinds of soups?
Oh, my gosh. That is such a game changer, because something really simple can then become so fancy. And what I love to do, and I'm going to recommend you to try this out too. When you're roasting your squash, add a little bit of baking soda along with the salt. It will make the flavors even stronger and more pronounced. And then flavor it with whatever you want. I usually add something crunchy. If I'm feeling lazy, I'll grab the bag of, what are those French crispy fried onions. Sprinkle a little bit of that on top and call it a day.
Fantastic. Let's go back to our callers now. Marvin is with us in Menominee. Marvin, hi.
Hey, hello. Thank you for taking my call, and it's an excellent topic today. 3 years of cooking commercially and at home, I've found that the absolute best way to ensure your vegetables become flavorful, people like them, etc., and they look good, is to roast them. Roasting them, just there's so many things to that product, whether no matter what vegetable it is, onions, carrots, of course, potatoes, but peppers, Brussels sprouts. Mm-hmm. Yes, you know, you get some color to them. You can season them the way you like them. They look so much better than an insipid pile of vegetables that's been steamed or boiled, you know, and dropped on a plate.
Marvin, thanks a lot for that call. I'm on your side. And Nick, I got to say, my personal veggie cooking game went way up when I discovered too late in life the magic of roasting vegetables. It really brings out so much flavor.
It absolutely does. Roasting is probably one of the best techniques in cooking.
Thanks a lot for that call, Marvin. Are there surprising vegetables, Nick, that people might not think of for putting in the oven that work surprisingly well?
Oh, that's a good question. So, you know, I think any vegetable that's really rich in sugar benefits from roasting, but also one of the vegetables that I really don't cook with a lot in the oven are cabbages. Now, if you cut cabbage into wedges or even just into chunks, toss them with a little bit of olive oil, season them the way you normally would, put them in the oven and roast them at about 400 to 425 Fahrenheit. The leaves turn really delicious. They almost start to melt away and they become even more sweeter. That's why I think roasting is just one of the most transformative techniques in cooking.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Nick Sharma on this edition of Food Friday. His new book is Veg Table: Recipes, Techniques, and Plant Science for Big Flavored Vegetable-Focused Meals. Let's check out another recipe you sent along. You've got a potato dish here for us, Bombay potato croquettes. So this is, you write, your hometown way back when. Talk about these croquettes.
Okay, so these croquettes are really simple to make. And, you know, if you have store-bought mashed potatoes, they'll work here well too. Now, this recipe is actually based. So in India, we love potatoes a lot. And usually they're fried in some kind of form. And frying, I think, always makes things easier. So this dish is based on that. The croquettes are mashed, fried, and then served with a spiced tomato chutney. They're perfect as little bites for any party, but also on the weekend. This is something I'll make and snack for movie night. It is so, so good.
Excellent. And when you're putting together a meal, you're right, you're not vegan. Not the recipes in the book aren't all necessarily vegan. How do you put together, you know, different veggies? How do you set that whole menu with some of the veggie concepts in your book?
So if I'm setting a menu up for guests with people, the one thing that I think about is how heavy are the vegetables? So veggies that are usually starchy tend to be much more filling, much more satisfying. So potatoes, squashes, winter squashes, they can be quite heavy. Sweet potatoes, that's another one of my favorite vegetables. So I tend to, if that's going to be the entree, then my sides and accompaniments and even my starters tend to be much smaller. So play with kind of how heavy a vegetable might feel and then kind of space your menu out. Now, if I were doing something like a main course that is lighter, but it's a salad, then I'll throw in things that are a little heavier. And sometimes I'll play with croutons. So I won't add bread as croutons. I'll roast sweet potatoes in little dice-shaped forms, roast them, use them as croutons in a salad. So there are a lot of fun things that you can do with a salad when preparing a menu with vegetables. Just play with the textures and see how filling they might feel.
Oh, that salad reminds me, by the way, another recipe you highlighted for us, the broccoli za'atar salad. So this is this spice, often in a blend format, the za'atar. Tell us a little bit about this broccoli salad with the za'atar.
So this is a fresh broccoli salad. The broccoli's kind of, it's crunchy. It's got all its flavor inside. And then it's tossed with za'atar, which is a Middle Eastern spice blend and contains sesame seeds and oregano usually, or the herb za'atar, which is less frequently found in America. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that goes in here is date syrup. If you don't have date syrup, you can use molasses. A little bit of pomegranate molasses are also in this. So it's sweet, tangy, and very earthy and really wonderful during winter. And what I've also done in this salad, I've put dried cranberries, and you can also use dried sweetened tart cherries just for a little bit of sweet acidity. So it's fruity, it's got the fresh taste of broccoli, and it's a light broccoli salad.
In just our last minute or so, Nick, you mentioned those sweet potatoes. That's another one I love, oven roasting. Leave us with some thoughts on what to do with our sweet potatoes this winter.
Sweet potatoes. So with sweet potatoes, obviously roast them, because to me, that's the best technique available to get their flavors out. Makes the texture much better. The other things that I like to do with sweet potatoes, I mentioned earlier, use them as croutons in your salad. Use them in place of chicken if you're making kung pao. It works really well, and there's a recipe for that in the cookbook. Another dish that you can make with sweet potatoes is, I like to make a sweet potato puree, and then add a little bit of garlic, a little bit of olive oil. You can add butter if you like butter. It's just a vegetable that gives so much in different ways and different textures.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Nick Sharma is a molecular biologist and chef. We listened back to our conversation with him about his new cookbook, Veg Table: Recipes, Techniques, and Plant Science for Big-Flavored Vegetable-Focused Meals. There's still time for you to let us know about your favorite veggies to cook with, or the ones that maybe give you trouble. What tips do you have for us when it comes to making vegetables, whether that's sautéing, roasting, or something else? What do you know now that you wish you knew earlier? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Maybe send a picture of that great recipe you're making this weekend. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the United Methodist Church is seeing a big split, mainly over issues related to the church's treatment of LGBTQ worshipers. Get different perspectives on the dispute and join in the conversation yourself. If you're part of that story, that's Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Speaking of vegetables, here's a new one, new for me anyway, that's been popping up in my grocery store lately. It's been labeled as gray squash, which doesn't sound too appetizing, or calabaza squash. It's like a zucchini, but a little more gray in color on the outside. It's more dense and sturdy. I tried it a couple times now, cooking it just like I would, you know, a zucchini, and I'm liking it. It stays a little more solid in heat in my experiments so far. Of course, it's not really a new vegetable. I looked it up on some food sites online. It has a long history in cooking in Mexico and elsewhere. In addition to being called gray squash or calabaza, it apparently gets called Middle Eastern or Lebanese squash, even though it originated in the Americas. Want to hear from you. I'm just finding this now. Have you been eating it, maybe cooking with it your whole life? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. Our mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new vegetables, and boldly cook what I've never cooked before. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Parrott. Republicans in the Wisconsin State Assembly voted yesterday in favor of a bill calling for a statewide binding referendum on banning abortions after 14 weeks of gestation. That comes after lots of back and forth on abortion law here in the state. In its 2022 Dobbs decision, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the right to abortion provided by Roe v. Wade. As a result, an 1849 Wisconsin law came back into effect, banning all abortions except in cases of extreme medical necessity. But last year, a Dane County judge interpreted the state's law from 1849 as applying to infanticide, not abortion. While the matter is likely headed to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, some providers in the state have resumed offering abortion services. We're going to talk about that recently passed assembly bill, a likely veto of that bill, and Governor Evers announcing earlier this week his plan to provide free birth control over the counter to recipients of Badger Care, and how it all fits into wider debates about reproductive care issues in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this bill out of the assembly? A Republican saying, hey, Wisconsinites should get to have a say as to whether abortion should be illegal after 14 weeks. How accessible is abortion and contraceptive care where you live? Did you see a change after the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision? Join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jenny Higgins is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison, where she's director of the Population and Reproductive Health Division and director of the Collaborative for Reproductive Equity. Jenny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's nice to be here. Nice to meet you.
And you too. Well, I want to start with this law passed by the assembly. It still has ways to go. It'd have to go to Governor Evers, likely to veto it. But I want to give a listen to Republican Wisconsin Representative Amanda Nedweski from Assembly District 61, including Pleasant Prairie. Here she is previewing the bill.
43 out of 50 states prohibit abortions after a point in time in pregnancy. Most European countries also limit abortions to the first trimester. Allowing abortion well into the second trimester is rare throughout the U.S. and the rest of the civilized world. We are here to ask the people of Wisconsin if they agree. The proposed ballot question in AB 975 is responsive to standards that public opinion has deemed normal in many other states, whether we like that or not. Moving from 20 weeks to 14 weeks could save hundreds of lives.
I want to get some background on abortions and the timing. First of all, what do we know about when abortions usually happen during the progression of a pregnancy?
Yeah, it's a great question. So most abortions in the United States take place in the first trimester of pregnancy. So in Wisconsin, the last year from which we have data for this, 88% took of abortions occurred within the first trimester of pregnancy, and the remaining 12% took place after the first trimester. I think it's important to not only have your listeners know that abortions after the first trimester are relatively uncommon, but they also are a really, really important service for a variety of different types of people for a different types of reasons. And this sort of nuance might be hard to get across to voters in a referendum. So does that answer your question about the prevalence of first versus second trimester abortions in Wisconsin?
It does. And it gives me an obvious follow-up when people are seeking abortions after that first trimester. And I'm gathering that's in that 12 to 14 week range. What is leading that to that decision in most cases?
There are several reasons for folks seeking abortion care after 12 weeks. One, and this is thanks to my UW-Madison colleague, Jenna Nobles, and her research. One reason is that there are some physiologic reasons for some people for later detection of pregnancy. So many people may be unable to physiologically know that they're pregnant early on in the first trimester due to chronic health conditions such as polycystic ovarian syndrome or diabetes, and therefore bans that cut into gestational age could be unconstitutional to folks who are facing those types of healthcare conditions and healthcare issues. So that's one group. That's one reason. Another reason is that many restrictions in Wisconsin and elsewhere make abortions really difficult to get, even if they're clinically available. So because of Medicaid prohibitions, because of 24-hour waiting periods, because of the need to take time off from work and miss wages and find childcare and whatnot, people need more and more time to raise the funds and to get through the logistical hurdles to actually get care. So many people are delayed in getting abortions within the first trimester, not because they aren't clear that they want an abortion, but because they cannot access one easily given all their existing restrictions. And of course, finally, some people may be learning about a health condition or a fetal condition later in the pregnancy than is possible in the first trimester. And this is a small but very important group of people who need care, abortion care later in pregnancy.
Now, a lot of times abortion restrictions will have an exception in case of a threat to the life of the mother. That can be evaluated a lot of different ways, I've heard. It can be hard to say 100% in some cases. How does that kind of exception typically work, especially as we're getting into mid and later pregnancy?
Yeah, it's a great question, and one I would want to defer to my policy colleagues on this. But something like a fetal anomaly that would lead to an immediate demise of the fetus upon having that condition and being birthed, that is not an immediate threat to the health of the pregnant person, but can still be a really important reason why people do seek termination later in pregnancy versus being forced to give full term birth to a fetus that has not been alive for several months. So it's a really complicated and very morally complex thicket. And yet the cases that the reasons people seek care after the first trimester are usually for a really good range of personal, medical, and logistical reasons.
We are talking to Jenny Higgins, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison, about laws relating to abortion and some of the timelines when we talk about cutoff dates in abortion laws. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts on what you'd like to see laws in Wisconsin look like, abortion access and contraceptive access look like in Wisconsin. Join in at 800-642-1234. Jenny, can you take us back now before the Dobbs decision, before the U.S. Supreme Court changed things and reverted a lot of state laws into effect? How accessible were abortions in Wisconsin, and how might that vary from person to person, place to place?
Yeah, it's a great question. while the Dobbs decision was a dramatic change to the abortion care landscape, abortion in Wisconsin had been very hard to access for many people for years before the Dobbs decision. And this is especially true for people living on low incomes, because people must pay for abortion care out of pocket in a way that they don't have to pay for prenatal care or birthing costs out of pocket in our state. It's also true for people living in rural areas and in northern areas of the state. So prior to Dobbs, and now currently in our state, abortion care is available in three different places: in Dane County, in Milwaukee County, and in Sheboygan County, very recently in Sheboygan County. While those places can serve a good part of the southern part of the state, that leaves 69 counties in our state without an abortion provider and large swaths of the northern and western part of our state without abortion care nearby. And research has shown that even a driving distance of 100 miles can be insurmountable for someone who is facing financial scarcity, childcare challenges, and other things. So abortion care, I say, was already hard to get. And my colleagues at UW-Madison, Joanna Venator and Jason Fletcher, had done an analysis of birth data and abortion data in Wisconsin in the years between 2010 and 2017, when a host of restrictions in our state led to the closure of two clinics in our state. So one in Appleton closed down and one in Green Bay. And the authors or the investigators found that counties that lost the most distance to those clinics experienced significant increases in birth rates and significant decreases in abortion rates, suggesting that even before the Dobbs decision, people in Wisconsin were being forced or back-ended into giving birth and carrying pregnancies to term who wouldn't have done so had abortion been more available.
We're talking to Jenny Higgins, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison, looking at access to different kinds of reproductive health care in Wisconsin. Republicans in the state assembly passed a bill yesterday that would call for a state referendum on a ban on abortions after 14 weeks of pregnancy. That still has a ways to go, including through the governor's office. And we'll talk about Governor Evers' plan to provide contraceptive medication over the counter for free for Badger Care recipients. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Do you think that various kinds of abortion limitations should go to a voter referendum? Why or why not? Is this an issue that motivates you to go to the polls and vote? Is this something that's affected you in your life, in your family as well? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the state of reproductive health care in Wisconsin with Jenny Higgins. She's a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison, where she's director of the Population Reproductive Health Division and director of the Collaborative for Reproductive Equity. A couple things going on, of course, back and forth on an old state law since the Dobbs decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. Assembly passing a bill saying, hey, voters, you decide on a 14-week abortion ban. And we'll talk about that next. Governor Evers saying contraceptive care free for some versions of it free for Badger Care recipients. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jenny, as I've mentioned, we heard from Governor Tony Evers this in the State of the State address that he's going to make over-the-counter contraceptives free to recipients of Badger Care. Can you talk about what that could mean for access to birth control, especially for low-income people who might be on Badger Care?
Yeah, that is a decision that could certainly increase access to contraceptive care, especially for folks living with financial scarcity or living on low incomes. We've done some research, or some of our colleagues at the Guttmacher Institute have done research to show that Wisconsinites have a pretty wide variety of preferences for how they want to receive contraceptive care, right? Some people like going to a doctor's office. Some people like getting telehealth. And we found that 40% said their top preference for receiving contraception would be at a pharmacy. So we see that for some people in our state, getting birth control available over the counter is a preference that this policy would help meet. Granted, this Evers decision only is in regards to emergency contraception as opposed to all other types of hormonal contraception that we know can be delivered safely by pharmacy. So perhaps it's a step in the direction to getting other FDA-approved methods available over-the-counter as well.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Dick is with us in Brooklyn. Dick, hi.
Hi, and I'd just like to make a comment. I find a fair amount of hypocrisy in the fact that the same folks that want to limit access to abortion are also the same folks who want to limit access to contraception, to prenatal care facilities, to health care for youth, or to provide lunches for schools. So they don't want to allow the abortion, but they don't want to help care for those kids after they're born.
Dick, thanks for the call. Jenny, I don't know if you want to get into the politics. I want to take one of the points Dick mentioned there. Does contraceptive access, say a state with high levels of contraception access, reduce demand for abortions? Is there any research on that? Do we know anything about that?
Yes, certainly. I mean, the more patient-centered, comprehensive contraceptive services a place has available, the more people are better able to prevent pregnancies, right? And so I think that we can lean into pregnancy prevention as well as the social safety net as really important common ground on this issue. I think that abortion can be very deeply personal and moral, even though, of course, as a professional person in medicine and public health, part of my professional mandate is to support access to abortion. I appreciate that it's a really complicated issue, but I do feel as if we really can, at a minimum, come to common ground over how do we help provide care and services to people who want to prevent pregnancies and who may need social safety net support if and when they do have children.
Thanks again for that call, Dick, at 800-642-1234. Randy joins us now in Ozaukee County. Randy, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up?
So my question, comment, concern is a lot of the abortion laws are made with the females in sight, but I am questioning, is it a consideration to bring the males who are also a part of the reproduction process for terminating a pregnancy and also having a say into any of the laws that are being brought forth to protect the men on the opposite side of wanting the child versus the female wanting to have an abortion?
Randy, thanks for the call. This is an argument that comes up sometimes, Jenny, that men should be part of the abortion decision for the pregnant woman. Do you have thoughts on that and the impact it might have?
Oh my gosh, it's such a great, complicated question. And we're analyzing some data right now in my team around involvement of the co-conceiver, involvement of the other person in the pregnancy and abortion decision. So I really appreciate your question, Randy. I will remind your listeners that there are excellent contraceptive options for people who have sperm, right? And while I'd like to see more and more shorter acting methods, certainly vasectomy is a method of contraception, granted a permanent one, that has one third of the side effects and is also cheaper than tubal ligation, or what we think of as called sometimes female sterilization. So I don't want us to forget about the fact that people who produce sperm can really play an active role in contraception, including through use of condoms, that we shouldn't overlook.
Thanks for that call, Randy, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Jenny Higgins, professor at UW-Madison, looking at abortion access, contraceptive access here in Wisconsin. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Jenny, I know it's no secret to you. You are in a line of research into an issue that is one of the most politically polarized, I think, in the country, or at least there are very strong opinions out there. How does that affect you as a researcher as you tackle these issues and try to make sense of them?
Yes, it's a question I grapple with each day, especially working in a large public institution, right, in a state that's politically complicated. I really love doing this research here in Wisconsin because there is such a need to document the harms or the impacts of restrictions on reproductive health care on Wisconsinites. So I'm really grateful to be doing the work in the state, but it does get really tricky. And I think that in an era of toxic polarization, really trying to connect with folks on what our evidence shows and what our research shows, while also holding that this is a personal issue. And what I encourage folks to think about is less whether they think abortion personally is moral or immoral, but more would they get in the way of a pregnant person making her own decision in consultation with her partner, her family, and her doctor. So that's what I may encourage your listeners to think about.
And one thing I'm curious about before we let you go, we had a period in Wisconsin between the Dobbs decision and then this Dane County judge saying, wait, hold on, the 1849 law doesn't block abortions, where effectively there were no or very, very limited abortions in Wisconsin. What do we know about the impact that had and people seeking abortions in neighboring states with different laws?
Yeah, so we know, of course, that when Roe v. Wade was overturned, all abortion services ceased in our state until September of this last year. So for over a year, there were no abortions available in the formal healthcare system in Wisconsin, except in cases of life-threatening situations to the pregnant person. So we have evidence from before Dobbs that about 16% of all abortion patients in Wisconsin were already leaving the state to get care. And while we don't have updated numbers yet on the post-Dobbs months, we would anticipate that a much larger percent of Wisconsinites traveled out of state to get care as a result of services being unavailable here. And so we know that some people have been able to travel out of state, but we have evidence that several hundred people a month following the Dobbs decision were not able to get over those obstacles to get care out of state, and were back into carrying pregnancies to term that they would not have otherwise.
Jenny, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate you paying attention to this fascinating and a really important issue.
That's Jenny Higgins, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison, director of the Collaborative for Reproductive Equity. She was with us to talk about reproductive health care access in the state after Assembly Republicans passed a bill yesterday calling for a binding statewide referendum on establishing a ban for abortions after 14 weeks of pregnancy. It's a long road to go before that would actually come into practice. Coming up Monday on Central Time, most American politicians have low approval ratings regardless of party. Find out why Americans are expressing more skepticism about public officials. That and more Monday here on Central Time.